Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam. We find that in the dialogues of Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam, with his companions, with his friends, with his relatives, with his family members, and with the people in general, he spoke quite a bit about Tawheed, Islamic monotheism. And of course, in an age where philosophical thoughts and theological opinions were being imported and infiltrated into the pure Muhammadan Islam, it was truly the endeavors and hard work and efforts of the Imams, including Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam, that saved and preserved the pure Muhammadan Islam. And so we see that it was very important for Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam to pay special attention to these matters of the oneness of Allah. Of course, we had seen what the Jewish people had done to the original Judaism and what the Christians did to the original teachings of Jesus Christ. And so perhaps in order to avoid falling into those traps, we find that Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam speaks in depth about the oneness of Allah. And so in one such conversation regarding Islamic monotheism and Tawheed, we find that Muhammad bin Isa asked Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam, "I imagine something." Now, Muhammad bin Isa was talking about imagining Allah. And so he said, "I imagine something." Interestingly, before Muhammad bin Isa could continue forwards and say something else, at that point, right then and there, Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam said to Muhammad bin Isa, "Yes, but Allah is not perceivable or limited. That which comes to your imagination is different from Allah. Nothing is like Allah, and imaginations cannot perceive Allah. For He is unlike whatever can be imagined by the mind." And so here we find, interestingly, that this is such a beautiful way to describe the oneness of Allah and to describe the attributes and the essence and the being of Allah. And this relates to the very present day as well. There are perhaps many of us who try to imagine what Allah is like. Now, this is a mistake because He cannot be perceived. Allah cannot be perceived. How can you imagine something in your mind which technically is unimaginable? Because our imagination cannot encompass and fully understand that which is Allah, the Supreme Being, the Constant Being, the only independent existence in all of existence. And so the more we try to imagine, perhaps the more we will become confused. So the only way out is for us to try to understand Allah based upon the teachings of the Qur'an and based upon the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And in that manner, will we be able to attain and reach true Tawheed, true Islamic monotheism. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old. Basically, look at the special wisdom that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to our ninth imam. What is zinat? Beauty. But let us go to the hadith of the imam, where imam talks about a zinat in a very different level. Well, hifz zinatul riwayah, or zinatul raviyah. In Islam, you know, riwayat, narrations, are part of our life. And this is where memory becomes very important. So those who are in this process of learning the ahadith and the narrations, for them, the beauty is in the ability to memorize those ahadiths. And this by itself is actually an art. You know, people learn how to do that. When you look at the people who have memorized the whole Quran, it's not a small book. But they're able to, you know, memorize the whole, you know, book. This needs a tutor, you know, to learn the method of how to do it. And even when it comes to hadith, there were many, many muhaddiseen. You will see with their names, they would sometimes be called al-hafiz so-and-so. They were not only hafiz of Quran, they were also hafiz of the hadith.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with the cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically. It made no sense politically. And basically, the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there is the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy, that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right? And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money. of course, on customs officials and this and that, and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new Chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the Prime Minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The streets of Rubeznoy in northern Donbass resemble an apocalypse. There was a major battle here between Russian and Ukrainian forces. It's now under Russian control, and the threat of incoming artillery now comes from the Ukrainian side.
Now, the Russians have been in control of this town for a couple of months now, but we've heard of a school that was hit very recently by Ukrainian artillery, so we're going to go there now and have a look.
School number 10. Locals say it was American HIMAR missiles that are responsible for these scenes. A decision will have to be made on whether to tear down the school or to attempt to repair the damage.
It was shelled on the 23rd of September. There was no military there. I live in the house in front of it, and I never saw any military. I'm the head of the educational department. They were preparing that school for the start of educational process, and we're cleaning it in preparation. Half of the school is destroyed.
We were planning to open three schools, but one school, number 10, wasn't able to open because it was hit by HIMARS. Luckily, it was at night and there was nobody there. It was during the referendum. It was hit on purpose, and it was hit directly because there's still some people in this town who are pro-Ukrainian, so they tell them where to strike.
While I've reported for many schools in Donbass that have been directly targeted by Ukraine, it's not clear whether this was hit due to its association with the recent referendum on joining Russia. Across the playground, a block of flats. One of the missiles landed outside this old woman's apartment. She calls the Ukrainians who did this cursed fascists, then bursts into tears. She was wounded in the blast and only recently returned from hospital. Inside, her kitchen has been blown out.
I'm nearly 70 and I'm afraid. Everybody is leaving. But where do we leave to? When the shell landed, I went out into the kitchen and looked. So I crawled under the bed. Everything is crumbling down. I woke up at night when a piece of wallpaper fell and covered me.
The American HIMAR missile system is amongst the most advanced pieces of military hardware in the world. Each missile costs $150,000. In Rubeznoy, they are being used to blow up schools and terrorize old women. Johnny Miller, Rubeznoy.
The Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a signed the last list of prisoners with Saudi Arabia, under which inmates will be exchanged between Sana'a and Riyadh. Head of the committee, Abdul Qadir al-Murtada, said the database that was an obstacle to the implementation of the agreement has been corrected.
The four Geneva Conventions, especially the third Convention on the Protection of Prisoners, mention the rules for the protection of prisoners as a humanitarian issue, and no party should link it to political matters. Unfortunately, countries on the Saudi-led coalition are working in line with the agenda of America and Israel, so it made no move until receiving American directives, and this has always been a hurdle to solving the rest of the issues.
Al-Murtada said a visit by the Sana'a delegation to Saudi prisons was successful, as the Yemeni prisoners were reassured that the swap deal would move forward. He hoped that the reciprocal visits will be a first step towards settling the humanitarian issue of the prisoner exchange.
The results of the recent visits were positive. The lists were corrected for both parties, and the names that will be exchanged between us and Saudi Arabia in the coming days have been signed. We in the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs consider the prisoners' issue as a humanitarian one. We should not be linked to military or political matters. If all parties are serious enough to resolve this issue, it will open up prospects for setting other issues as well.
Recently, a Saudi technical delegation visited Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh to verify the names of prisoners of both parties.
The warring sides in Yemen have taken a new step toward peace by visiting each other for the first time. Observers say if the prisoner swap deal moves forward, it could help end the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
¶¶
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Velayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
On Saturday, anti-government rallies and protests were held in the Italian capital. In the morning, high school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they call two decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout levels in the EU. They sent out a warning to the next government, saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards.
We are still wondering why the government hasn't scrapped a 2015 school reform. We demand the next executive to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school and to declare a state of emergency for Italy's school buildings.
Later on Saturday, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the government building. The initiative was organized by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally.
We want to stress how the lies told by the mainstream media on the conflict in Ukraine have brainwashed the Italian people. It's NATO who declared war on Russia using Ukraine as a tool. An end must be put on this historical phase made of imperialistic violence and the longing for expansion.
Italia Sovrana Popolare chiede.
Our movement demands the next government to pay in full for people's exorbitant bills and to review the country's foreign policy that is literally plunging our economy into chaos. But I am afraid the next executive will stick to the same line adopted by the outgoing Draghi government.
Italy is in the process to install a new government as the Mario Draghi government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right formation Brothers of Italy has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader Giorgia Meloni is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. More protests were held in Italy over the past days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by the Ansaldo Energy plant's employees against plans to close the factory. Also, The Italy's largest union, CGIL, staged a large demonstration in Rome about a week ago, demanding more protection for workers. A hot autumn of protests and strikes seemed to have just started in the country. Max Civili, Rome.
In what's being called a disaster for the ruling Democratic Party, inflation has reached a 40-year high in the final official reading before next month's midterm legislative elections. The data is even worse than it appears because the government excludes food and petrol from the official inflation rate. The record high is being driven by increases in other necessities such as lodging, medical care, and mass transportation.
You know, at this point everything's expensive, but we have to buy what we have to buy. So at this point, we're going to pay for everything. It's not very fun, but we do it.
No one likes the higher prices, including myself. So we're just trying to get through it until we can make enough money to be able to afford everything.
With prices rising 8.2% and wages increasing just 4.9%, economists say the average American effectively lost almost an entire day's pay last month. And that's using the official inflation rate. Even though almost every economic indicator is negative, the nation's bankers seem intent on restricting borrowing just when businesses are pulling back new job offers in record numbers and credit card debt is at a record high. The situation has already deteriorated into liberalism's theoretically unsolvable dilemma, stagflation, which is recession plus inflation. The right-wing economic policies may also produce political stagnation. The likely Republican takeover of the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate would hobble President Joe Biden's ability to get any major legislation passed for the next 2 years. The nation's bankers are trying to stop price increases by destroying the demand for goods and services. The reduced demand should lower prices eventually, but the policy rules out wage increases for workers and keeps corporate profits high. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has held a big protest in the Gaza Strip to condemn the surge of Israeli attacks in Al-Quds and on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. People thronged the streets of the blockaded territory following the Friday prayer to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and asserted that armed resistance is the key to reaching freedom.
We condemn the Zionists' provocations in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we salute the freedom fighters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Today, we're entering a new era where armed resistance against Zionist occupiers is the strategic choice, not only in Gaza, but also in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and everywhere in Palestine.
Protesters also expressed their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression and attacks. Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. Occupied by Israeli forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
Al-Quds is the core of our struggle against the Zionist enemy, and we are willing to die in order to protect it. Zionist forces and settlers are skirting Al-Aqsa, and we must escalate the resistance against the Zionist occupiers.
This is while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinians here are calling for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israeli plots over Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Less than 4 weeks before the United States midterm legislative elections, the committee investigating the election-related protests on January 6, 2021, announced that they will subpoena ex-President Donald Trump to testify. However, most analysts believe Trump will not ultimately testify, and his written response to the panel was noncommittal. Trump has reportedly been telling aides he favors testifying as long as it would be done in a live public hearing, but the commission isn't likely to agree to that. Almost 2 years after the presidential election, the country appears to be as divided as ever, with Trump supporters calling the subpoena an October surprise meant to influence the midterms, while anti-Trump partisans say the subpoena proves that not even an ex-president is above the law. The January 6th committee has been alternatively branded as a necessary defense of American-style democracy or as a staged show trial. What appears certain, however, is that it has had seemingly no effect on the American public. In poll numbers, which are virtually unchanged despite nearly 2 years of intense mainstream media focus on the committee, 35% of America still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% of the country still calls it an insurrection. Over 60% of Republicans still believe the 2020 election was illegitimate. In 2017, polls showed that over 60% of Democrats still believed the 2016 election was illegitimate. America's political division did not begin on January 6, 2021, and it does not appear that the committee will fully unite the nation by voting day on November 8th. The news of the subpoena was announced on what many say was likely the commission's last public hearing. The final report is expected shortly after the elections. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The battered town of Obeznoy. I came here to find out if locals are fearful of the Ukrainian army, who have made recent gains not far to the west. A local school in the center of town.
Yes, we are worried. If the Ukrainian army comes here, there will be reprisal against teachers. But our strength is in the hope that it will never happen. I have colleagues whose children happen to be on the other side. They are afraid of coming to work because they are scared for their children and themselves.
Why do you think Ukraine would kill teachers? What's the reasoning behind that?
They say that we are ideological frontline workers and we are involved in Russian propaganda. This is the main thing that teachers are blamed for, but this region is 80% Russian speakers.
Irina, who's lived in this town all her life, tells me that she has heard rumors that teachers have been killed in Kupiansk, a town recently taken by Ukraine. This shocking video was posted online, claiming to be civilians in Kupiansk. It was uploaded by Maxim Zorin, a former member of Ukraine's notorious Azov Regiment, although he later altered his post, claiming the video had been taken from a Russian soldier's phone.
Now, to my knowledge, this is the only video that has surfaced in this war so far that clearly shows civilians being executed and dumped into a mass grave. Now, this video has been completely ignored by the mainstream media of NATO countries. Why? Because the evidence suggests a strong likelihood that these are Ukrainian soldiers executing pro-Russian civilians.
A headline from Britain's Daily Mail newspaper. The article quotes an advisor to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. A hunt has been declared on collaborators, and their life is not protected by law. Our intelligence services are eliminating them, shooting them like pigs. A humanitarian center. The Ukrainian government have not only threatened teachers, but those who distribute or receive humanitarian aid with jail.
We did nothing bad. We tried to help children and elderly people. What did we do? We were giving out aid under shelling. We helped people who couldn't walk. What shall we be afraid of? We just helped. I think there's nothing bad in it.
One of the volunteers asks us for a lift to help an old woman nearby.
What do you think of the Ukrainians threatening people who take humanitarian aid?
We heard of it. We even saw a video that in Kupiansk, some guys were taken into trenches and shot in the head. We have no internet, no proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people, Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. Indeed, most in Donbass expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Johnny Miller, Lebeznoy, Donbass.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The media is in the hands of Zionists and their partners in Washington. They cover whatever events they want, and they ignore what they think is not necessary to be heard by world people. The issue of Palestine has always been one of those hot issues that the Western media tries to ignore. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Palestine Chronicle wrote, "Just in 2022, with nearly 3 months still to go, more than 160 Palestinians have been killed on the West Bank amid scenes of rampaging settlers on Palestinian land and ceaseless provocations on the Haram al-Sharif by extremists, as if any Zionist is not by definition an extremist. Many of the West Bank dead are children who indeed have been the victims in their thousands ever since 1948, when they were slaughtered with their families or died on the road from thirst, hunger, and exposure after being driven out of their homes and towns by European colonists who brought their sick racist ideology to Palestine. It was not just Palestine, of course, but the children of other countries, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, whose innocent lives were cut short in the raids and missile attacks of these killers. Most of these epithets have been forgotten. One thinks of the bombing of the primary school in the Egyptian town of Bahr al-Baghr on April 8, 1970, when 46 children were killed and more than 50 wounded. The tools used to kill them were American F-4 Phantom jet fighter aircraft and missiles. Did the U.S. restrain its vicious little friend? No. It accepted that this was just another mistake, like the deliberate air and sea attack on the USS Liberty in 1967, which left 34 seamen dead and dozens wounded. The killing of children moves forward year after year up to and beyond the localized genocide at Sabra and Shatila in 1982. As the Zionist regime is never punished, whatever the heinous nature of its crimes, like any criminal who is never caught, it continues doing what it has always done best, apart from sucking tens of billions of dollars out of the American taxpayers' pockets, which is killing civilians in Palestine or around its borders. Take as a representative example the young American Jew who goes to the occupied territories and joins the army or the border police. He or she stands at a checkpoint, shoots at unarmed or scarcely armed Palestinian dead, and goes back to New York and wherever as a hero in the war on terrorism, as they call it. Bravery is not required, just a bit of easily acquired expertise in handling an assault rifle and the ability to kill someone a couple of meters away. That someone might be a woman approaching armed men and women slouching around the checkpoint. They are heavily armed and in no danger, but the woman is in deadly danger. Of course, she knows it all. She would be a most unusual Palestinian if she did not have a husband, children, brothers, parents, grandparents, and cousins who had not been killed by these people. As brave as she can be in her determination to do something for the resistance, she approaches the checkpoint. She might have a knife in the hand, but she still could easily be disarmed by one soldier knocking the knife out of her hand. She could be disabled with a leg wound, but instead she is deliberately shot and left to die where she falls. If she does not die immediately with no ambulance called in time to save her, the young American can go home as a hero with the credit of killing what they baselessly call terrorists. These murders, let us not call them anything else, are not aberrant but normative behavior in a state which has bred generation and generation of psychopaths, as further evidence in the glee shown by snipers killing Palestinians, young and old, through the Gaza fence. Also, the Defense of Children International has more than 35 branches, one of them Palestinian. This gives a grand total of 2,224 deaths. The 2022 figure does not include the number killed in Operation Breaking Dawn in August, as at the date of the publication of these figures, they were still being collated. Neither does it include the latest killings. Furthermore, the year still has a long way to go, and more children are going to be killed. The hypocrisy of the so-called West is something we can take for granted, because it is no more than typical of its behavior. But these are innocent children whose deaths should be the cause of outrage and demands that the Zionist regime be shown the door from the UN and any other credible international organization. Of the number of children listed as killed from 2000 to 2022, 514 were aged 8 or under. Sometimes we see the faces, but never in the Western media, which rarely even names them. Their names and their faces should be front page news.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi,
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim, Shiite scholars and ulama all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the faqih Mutakallim and one of the main authors of the 14th century Hijrah, who was based in the city of Najaf, Sheikh Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar. We can say the author of the magnum opus Dalail al-Sidq li-Nahj al-Haq. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Sheikh Muhammad Hassan Muzaffar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar was born in 1301 according to lunar calendar in Najaf al-Ashraf. And his father, Sheikh Muhammad, was one of the scholars in Najaf. And, you know, his family, they all were integrated in Islamic studies and they were, you know, involved in this field. And we may say that he was from an scholar family. We should say that... Al Muzaffar is one of the big tribes in Iraq. And we should know that this man, this scholar, Sheikh Muhammad Hassan Al Muzaffar, after a while of studying in Islamic Seminary of Najaf, came to a position that late Ayatollah Agha Buzurg Tehrani, the author of Al-Dhari'ah, talking about him, said that Sheikh Muhammad Hassan Al Muzaffar is one of the great scholars of Al Muzaffar. Okay. And we should know that he is not the only scholar in this tribe. Yes, yes. We have others like Marhum Muhammad Rida Al Muzaffar.
We produced one program on him.
Yes.
Okay.
The one that is known as one of the great scholars who were trying to renovate
The
Islamic studies in Najaf al Ashraf.
And organize the Hausa books in the new method.
That's yes.
Right. Okay.
By the way, late Ayatollah Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar started his studies in Najaf al-Ashraf. He got benefit from late Mahum Muhammad Kazim al-Khurasani, namely known as Akhund al-Khurasani, for a short time. And mainly he got benefited from Sheikh Ali Jawahiri and late Sheikh al-Sharia Isfahani, rahmatullah alayhi. And this is important that Sheikh al-Sharia Isfahani and Agha Buzurg Tehrani, they gave permission of riwayat to Sheikh Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar. And you know, this permission of riwaya means that the scholar authorized the student to be able to narrate a hadith from different resources for other people.
That's right.
After a while, he was a mujtahid. Mujtahid means the person who is prominent to drive out the ahkam and rulings from ayat and riwayat.
Yes.
And about some rulings, he had exceptional, you know, ideas.
That's right.
The you know that these ideas were different from the scholars at his time. That it shows the you know open mind of the scholars that they discuss and may they come to different results and different you know ideas that maybe you know not compatible with the other scholars.
That's right. For example, marriage with Ahlul Kitab, or for example, moon sighting upon is the responsibility of Hakim al-Shar, you know.
Yeah.
That is the main, we can say, that's right, the top ranking official of a Muslim land and so on. Okay, that's all right. But Sheikh Mahtavi, beside all these and all his innovations regarding Islamic rulings, Muhammad Hassan Muzaffar was known for his magnum opus, Dalail al-Sidq li-Nahj al-Haq. And this has a history behind. Let's first be concerned with the history. What is the history behind compiling such a book?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you mentioned, Dalail al-Sidq li-Nahj al-Haq. First of all, let's know the meaning of this title, and then we will get into the history, as its history is going to engage 5 centuries of the Islamic history. Dalail al-Sidq means proofs of authenticity for the path of truth.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to keep in mind that the second part of the book shouldn't be translated like this, because this is the title of another book, Nahj al-Haq. This is the moment we are going to get into the history of this book. And what is the history? When one of the Ilkhanid king, whose name is Qiyasuddin Muhammad Khudabande, who is also famous of Al-Jaito or El-Jaito.
Yes, yes.
In the age 700, who passed away in age 716, make the Shia sect as the official religion of the Iran.
Okay.
At that time,
Persian,
this is very
time.
This is very important for our listeners. Why? Because these days we are hearing that we don't have a very profound history of becoming or being Shia in Persian territory. So when you look at the history, almost 6 centuries ago, we see that the religion has been recognized as what? As the official religion.
Well, what was the date again? Sorry? 700?
716 is the date he passed away.
Okay.
He is born in... He didn't have a long life. Yes.
Al-Jaito, you mean?
Yes, Al-Jaito.
Okay.
But by the way, it was during the 7th and 8th century.
But he announced Shia sect as the official religion of the Persian lands.
Yes. So he will request Allama Hilli to introduce a book on Shiism. And that moment, we see that he will introduce the book entitled Nahj al-Haq. So this is the generation, or this is the initiative point for all history.
Okay.
So almost 1 century after this, we see one of the Sunni scholars, in order to write the rebuttal book, will author the book entitled Ibtal Nahj al-Batil. As it is mentioned, his book is full of insult and offensive words against the Shiism.
Shiism, okay.
And again, after 1 century, we see another Shia scholar.
Sorry, the second book was written by Fazl ibn Ruzbahan Khunji.
Yes, yes, one of the scholar whose name is...
Khunji.
Yes, Fazl ibn Ruzbahan Khunji, who is one of the Ash'ari scholars.
Yes, yes.
So he tries to rebuke and refute this book.
Allama Hilli's book.
Yes.
Okay.
And after almost 1 century, we see another book entitled... Ihqaq al-Haq.
Yes.
Another book, Ihqaq al-Haq wa Izhaq al-Batil, written by Qadi Nurullah al-Shushtari.
Yes.
It was a very voluminous book,
Mm-hmm.
Including 36 volumes, yes, that there are some of the records saying that because of his book, he got martyred.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, he wrote such a book in order to have a kind of rebuttal book for this. So we see how our scholars were committed to the religion. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't tolerate hearing something against the truth.
Yes.
So we see at the end of this line, Sheikh Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar, as my brother said, quoting Agha Buzurg Tehrani, Allamata al-Muzaffar, he is trying to summarize that book. Actually, as the intention of his work, he is saying that since the book Ihqaq al-Haq was a very huge book, including 36 volumes, I wanted to present a shorter or smaller one. I put everything in 7 volumes entitled this as what we said, Dalail al-Sidq li-Nahj al-Haq. Here, li-Nahj al-Haq means proof for the authenticity of that book.
Uh-huh.
Again, you may take it as the path of truth.
Yes,
that book.
That's
so it's going to quote the whole history starting from 5 centuries ago up until now.
It's really interesting, you know, what a rich history is behind compiling such a book. And as you said, generation after generation feel committed in order to answer by writing a book. This is really important.
And this book also itself, 7 volumes.
Yes.
Each volume including something around 500 or 600 pages. So the average, you may put it in 3,000 or let's say 3,500 pages.
That's all right.
It's too much.
Yes.
But the main book, which was the rebuttal book for the Nahj al-Haq, was something around 500, 600, being written by that scholar, Khunji.
That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Okay, Sheikh Ziyanian, can you give us a picture of the main content of this book? I mean, Dalail al-Sidq li-Nahj al-Haq, compiled by Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar.
So about the content of this book, we should know that because it's trying to, you know, answer the problems and the issues that were posed by the book of Ibn Ruzbahan, that was Ibtal al-Batil.
Yes.
So the content of Dalail al-Sidq is somehow dependent on the book of Ibtal al-Batil. So he says that in some places, Ibn Ruzbahan quotes some unauthentic or fake concepts and sentences in his book. And even sometimes Ibn Ruzbahan tries to curse upon Allama Hilli.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, cursing upon scholars is not something, you know, scholarly accepted in, you know, scholarly discussions. We should know that he brings the words of Allama Hilli Rahmatullah Alayh at the beginning, because the book Nahj al-Haq is the first book. Then Marhum Muzaffar brings the words of Ibn Ruzbahan in Ibtal al-Batil. And then after these two texts, he brings his own ideas explaining the idea of Allama Hilli Rahmatullah Alayh and rejects the idea of Ibn Ruzbahan, who was the one who trying to rebuttal the book Nahj al-Haq. In the second volume, he tries to identify and explain the Firqatun Najiyah, because Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam in one of his sayings mentions that his ummah will be into different groups, and one of these groups would be the group that will achieve salvation.
Yes.
Now Allama Muzaffar tries to identify and explain this group, who they are, and he rejects and criticizes the idea of Ibn Ruzbahan regarding this.
That's right.
And we should know that he tries also to discuss about the attributes of God and also the concept of nubuwwah, prophecy, yes, and imamah, the ones who are successors of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And then he goes to discuss about the infallibility of anbiya and prophets and also a'immah or the imams. And we should know that he discusses about the necessity of the infallibility of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. And also he believes that, and he proves this, that imam, who is the leader of the society, must be superior in knowledge, in the, you know, piety and different fields. He should be superior to his people so that people accept him willingly, because he is more knowledgeable, he is more pious, he is more just and in different fields. And another issue that he discusses in his book is the way that imam should be chosen in the society, in Muslim society. And the last important point that is mentioned regarding this is that he considers, and he brought different ideas about the choosing of imam in Muslim ummah, okay, that there are different ideas regarding this amongst Ahlul Sunnah and right, amongst the Shia school of thought.
That's all right. Anything, Miss Sheikh?
And maybe only referring to his humbleness and yes, his down-to-earth personality, because mm-hmm, when he was offered to lead the Salat in Jam al-Hindi, which is mm-hmm, one of the very famous yes, masajid in the Iraq, specifically in Najaf, to lead the Salat there, one of the great, most of the great scholars would lead the Salat as Imam al-Jama'ah. He didn't accept to go there and lead the Salat. And who was offering this? The Za'im al-Hawza, or the leader, the head of the Hawza at that time, Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani. He didn't yes, accept this.
Okay.
And he stayed keeping his salat and doing his salat in the masjid of his father, mm-hmm, which was one of these very ordinary and normal masajid. We see having this position in terms yes, of knowledge, yet humbleness and his down-to-earth personality okay, is really appreciated and acknowledged.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. The late Allama Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar passed away on Rabiul Awwal 23rd, 1375. According to the lunar Hijri calendar, in the city of Baghdad, and he was buried in the holy city of Najaf. May Allah bless the soul of Allama Muhammad Hassan al-Muzaffar, the author of the book Dalail al-Sidq li Nahj al-Haq, which is really an outstanding book, and so many people can benefit from reading that book. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call-of-islam-page. Then another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.